House Revenue Committee, welcome everybody here today for the brave walk through the Oregon Corporate Income Tax. And then following that we have committee bill introductions. So let's begin with the overview. Elizabeth, you're with us today and we welcome you. Paul, do you have anything before we begin?
No, Mr. Chair, we've got Elizabeth on corporate excise taxes, and then Deborah Buchanan is going to say a few things about the department's administration of the tax.
Okay, very good. Elizabeth.
Chairman Shetterly and committee members, for the record, again, I'm Elizabeth Martin-Mahar with the Legislative Revenue Office, and today we're just going to go through a kind of brief and, you know, real broad overview of corporate excise taxes. And basically with Oregon, we are taxing the business income of businesses that are actually doing business here in Oregon or that they have a physical presence here in Oregon. And that really is one of the things that is the tricky part of corporate excise tax, is determining that physical presence in the state. Now, to make sure everyone's clear, when we're seeing corporate excise tax, that's really the bulk of the corporate income taxes that we are hearing about as far as the revenue flows. Basically, what happens is those corporations that are doing business here in Oregon, they are paying the corporate excise tax. And then those businesses here in Oregon that do not have nexus in the sense of having the connection and the physical presence here in Oregon, but they do have other sources of income here in Oregon, then they pay the corporate income tax. Now, many times we just use these interchangeably, but just, you know, do recognize that, you know, the corporate excise tax is really what we're talking about, is the bulk of the money that is generated on corporations. That's what the large corporations are paying, is the excise tax.
Elizabeth, let me just interrupt for a second. Kathy, can we bring the lights down? But let's leave them on a little bit so folks who have materials back in the back can read those as well. Excuse me for this technical interruption. Okay, well, go ahead.
Yeah. So I'm just going to, again, kind of give you some comparison between over the last 10 years, between 1990 and 2000. And this first graph shows you the returns themselves. So as we can see, the and when I got here is not only any corporations that are paying income taxes, but also the sole proprietors, which we had talked about last time we had the personal income tax orientation, where the sole proprietors pass through and they just have, they file the personal income tax return, not any corporate income taxes. So we have sole proprietors in here, and I've also incorporated in the farms just because those are considered businesses and many times they're sole proprietors. S corporations also, they pass through their income to the on the personal income tax, and so they do not pay a significant amount of excise tax. So to begin with, when you're just looking at the large the returns, that is a breakdown, you can see that 67% of all the business income tax returns are sole proprietors. And again, sole proprietors are like one person. You know, it's a single individual that has their own small business. Now, you can see in 1990 there are 190,072 sole proprietors. Now, the next largest group then were the C corporations and the farms. And the C corporations, the C corporations were approximately 35,510, and then farms were roughly 36,948. So they both comprised about 13% of all the business tax returns. So when we think of business, the actual tax returns, C corporations do not make up a large portion of that.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Just one quick question. The rates then are different on sole proprietors and C-Corps. I mean, one is the corporate tax, one is the personal income tax rate.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hass, that's correct. Yes. So the on the sole proprietors, they're paying the personal income tax rates of 5.79%, and then the C-Corps, as we'll find out, they're paying the 6.6%. Now, as the changes we've seen now over the last 20 years then, sole proprietors, I mean, they grew roughly 10% over 10 years, so there was a slight growth there. As far as the percent of all the business income tax returns, you see that they only dropped slightly from 67% to 65%. The big jump here is really the S-Corps. The S-Corps were the smallest group in 1990 with only 18,437 returns. But they grew over 132% as far as the number of corporations that wanted to choose to be S-Corporations. Those grew from 7% of all business income tax returns to 13%. Of all business income tax returns.
Representative Scott.
LLCs, are they mixed in with the sole proprietor?
And also maybe I was going to ask about that in partnerships, limited liability partnerships and those other pass-through entities.
Representative Shetterly, I did not incorporate them into this graph. Basically, they're not there. We do have them captured in the data dealing with S corporations. There's also partnerships in that. But at the time, there also is other rental and royalty income, and I just didn't really want to incorporate all of that into these estimates. These are firm estimates as far as what are the returns that actually are filing business income. Because with S corporations, they also file to pay an excise tax of $10, which we'll talk about in a minute.
Let me just clarify then. We've got to be careful how we use the word incorporate here. But so LLCs, partnerships, limited liability partnerships, those kinds of entities are not reflected in those numbers, or they're buried, or they're included in one of those categories or the other?
Representative Shetterly, no, they're not included in this graph.
Okay. Because I would expect you'd have seen, at least based on my practice, the growth in limited liability companies has outpaced the growth in S corporations over the past 5 years. So I'm just curious how that would appear. Deborah, do you know offhand? Okay.
Yeah, and Representative Shetterly, it's not real clear data that we have at all.
Sure,
I mean,
because
it's all lumped in with it's the Schedule C,
right.
And so you've got everything in there, and it's not real clear what are the limited liability corporations and things. So this is really the S corporations, since they're paying the excise tax. That's
right.
How we can capture them, and they're distinct.
Sure, Representative Scott.
So if they're not included, where do they go?
Well, personal.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Scott, they file the personal income taxes. I mean, that's what they're paying, is that 5, 7, and 9 tax rate structure. And I'm not saying that we don't capture it in the personal income tax data. That was all part of the miscellaneous category that you saw when we had the personal income tax, information. But I'm just saying, when I was creating these graphs, I just wanted to be clear about what exactly, how much there were as far as business income tax returns. And I mean, I could have lumped them in here, but then you would have really kind of, under the S corporations and limited liability corporations, it inflates that number. And so it's not real accurate.
Representative Barnard, you have a question?
Thank you. This is a follow-up. Where would professional corporations go? Are they included under C corps, or are they, again, not on the list, or what happened?
I think a professional corporation can either be a C corp or an S corp.
Okay.
So
I think that depends. I think professional corporation doesn't necessarily put you in either one of those. You would elect either.
Well, if the election were for a C corp, let me clarify the question. Would they then go into that C corp list?
Representative Barnhart, that's correct.
Thank you.
Yeah, they would be paying the excise tax.
Well, just one of the things, then we'll let you get on, Elizabeth. But I guess this points up the when we see the numbers between business income, taxes paid to business income and personal income in Oregon, we have to keep in mind that there's a significant share of what is actually business income reflected in the personal income tax numbers because of the number of pass-through entities. And so it's not always as clean a break as it appears when you're looking at the difference between what individuals are paying and what business is paying as a share of tax in Oregon, where you have that business income on those pass-through entities lumped in with the personal income tax, just because you're right, they don't file any separate returns. They just reflect those business income directly on their personal income taxes. Okay.
Now, this just breaks down these business tax returns by income for 1990 versus 2000. for the different groups. And it just kind of gives you a little bit of a snapshot of kind of the makeup of these different business types. So as you can see, sole proprietors have very few returns that are actually losses. In 1990 versus 2000, it didn't change much at all. It's less than, you know, 1%. But you can see that a large majority are between the 0 to 20,000 income category. That makes up, you know, 30% of their returns. And that did, that went down a little bit over the 10-year period till maybe, you know, 15%. But then what you see is the largest group here is between 20,000 and 50,000 as far as the small businesses. That's the, you know, average category that these business income tax returns would fall in. And that's slightly dropped, but then what you saw was an increase then in the $50,000 to $100,000 category. So the biggest change for sole proprietors really was having more of the of more upper income categories being having more returns in those groups. Now with S corporations, what you see, and also with C corporations, you can see a large portion of those corporations, those tax returns, have losses. And you have nearly 40% of the S corporations in 1990, as well as the C corporations in 1990, having nearly 40% of the returns having losses. Then you can see that 0 to 20,000 is the next largest for S corporations, where you've got there about 40% of those have $0 to $20,000 in income. Now, the last income groups of 20,000 and above are really only comprising about 25% of all the tax returns for S corporations in 1990, where in 2000 with S corporations, it's a bit more. Those above 20,000 are make almost 40% of all the tax returns. Now, with C corporations, you've seen an increase then in the number of higher income returns, where in 1990 you can see C corporations between 0 and 20,000, you know, made over 80% of all the tax returns. And then here in 2000, what you see is, you know, a whole lot, not of a lot of change between the C corporations. Again, you've got losses and up to 20,000 making 80% of all the tax returns. But then you see here that there's a larger group of the 20,000 to 50,000 and the 50 to 100,000, and there's more of the above 500,000 as far as larger corporations having returns here in Oregon. Now, when you look at the same thing only on an income basis, then that's in 1990 what we saw were, where before we saw C corporations only made up 13% of the returns, will they make those 13% make up 44% of all the business income? And sole proprietors make up 40% of all the income, even though they made up over 60% of all the tax returns. Now, the S corporations are roughly about the same as what they were as far as percent of returns. They're roughly 15% of all the tax. And farms are roughly about 1%. And as you can see, farm income grew heavily negative, more negative over the 10-year period, from negative 67 million to negative 222 million. So then when you look at 2000 and what kind of changes took place, well, C corporations were already almost 50% of all of the income for businesses, and now they've grown in 10 years to 62% of all the income, business income, is from C corporations. And you can see sole proprietors fell as far as a percent of total income from 40% down to 21% of all income. S corporations, with the growth in S corporations, the sheer number, you did see that remain fairly constant as far as a percent of all business income. And farms grew as a larger portion because it's more negative. Now, I'm going to just begin to give you a brief overview of just some of the components of the business income tax statement. And this is thinking of this at the federal level. Again, I want to remind you of the connection that we now have, the rolling reconnect with the federal tax law. So corporations are taxed on their net earnings, and they will file. Here in Oregon, we tax the corporations that file a consolidated tax return at the federal level, and then that becomes the basis for Oregon's taxes. So to begin with, you look at the gross receipts or sales from all the different business operations of the corporation at the federal level. Then they will minus off the cost of the goods that are sold they will examine their inventories and the change in that over a given year, and then that becomes then their gross profit. And then what they will do is then consider in any net gains or losses that occur. That could be the selling of business property. You also could be having in there stock capital gains and things. Basically, that's going to then give you your total income, but then you're also going to be able to then have some adjustments, and this really includes a whole gamut of different deductions at the federal level, things like your payroll costs, so the compensation that you make to your employees, up to $1 million. There also is interest that you paid, also rental income that you had that you paid, then you would get a deduction for that. Depreciation comes in here. Now, things like bonus depreciation, when those changes were made at the federal level, then that is how we in Oregon then automatically connected to those law changes. And it would have taken a legislation here in Oregon in order to disconnect from those federal changes. So that's why you have to understand when we do see some changes surrounding, you know, the expending, like when we were talking about the Bush plan with the capital expending and increasing that amount of 179 expensing, then that was such that this will fall through to Oregon through this, because that's a deduction that's larger than it was under current law. So then that arrives then at net business income. And again, this is at the federal level. And then that is what is transferred then here to Oregon. So then in Oregon, the corporations will take that business income from the federal level, and then they will look at any additions and subtractions of differences between Oregon law and federal law. And then the big change here is then you will be looking at any net operating loss deductions, and basically that is can be carried forward then for 15 years. So if you do have an operating loss in your current year of your for the current year, you can use that against your tax liability. If you don't use it all in a given year, then you can carry a portion of that forward to be able to use for future tax years. So then that then creates the taxable income. And then what happens next is we just take that taxable income, and then that is times by the tax rate of 6.6%. And then that basically creates your total tax before credits. Now, this just kind of gives you a little bit of a picture of Oregon in relationship to other states as far as our 6.6 tax rate. And some states have a progressive tax rate structure, just like we have here in Oregon. And at the federal level, it's a progressive corporate tax rate structure. But these I've listed here, these are just 31 states, and these all have a flat tax rate. And so it just kind of gives you a little bit of an understanding of where 6.6 fits into the lineup of other states with a flat tax. And as you can see, if you count them from the top, we're basically 19th from the top as far as top being Pennsylvania with a tax rate of 10%. Oregon would sit right down here in 19th at a 6.6% rate. And actually, it corresponds pretty well with Oregon's ranking in 1990-2000 for corporate tax, which as a percent of income, we were ranked 18th. So basically, these tax rates are pretty bunched together, too, as you can see. You know, a lot of them are in 6 and 7, you know, rates, with only, like, Kansas down here being at 4%. Now, to give you a little bit of a snapshot here, in 2000, of what were the corporate tax credits that were used, and there was $35 million basically used. The largest one that you'll hear about usually each session is pollution control credit, and this was 28% of that $35 million. And basically, this allows a credit up to 50% of the cost of the pollution control facilities. So, and this investment must be certified by DEQ. And in 2000, there were roughly 100 different taxpayers who benefited from that credit.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Fox.
Thank you. On the corporate income taxes by state, I take it that Washington has no corporate income tax?
Correct.
And how about Idaho?
Representative Farr, Idaho. I know they have a corporate income tax, but...
It's graduated?
I think it's graduated.
Thank you.
Now, as far as the credits, pollution control is the largest, 28%. Then you've got, like, the research credit, which is one of the some changes to that as part of what the LC draft that you'll be looking at this morning. So with the research credit, that's basically 5% of the amount of research over a base amount of qualified research. And the research is limited under current law to just fields of high tech, advanced computing, advanced materials, biotechnology, environmental technology, or straw utilization. Now, another the other credits is roughly 24%, and that's like insurance credits. There's a variety of other ones incorporated in that. Then next you see the business energy credit is only 7%, so you can see there's quite a drop between these three, you know, the pollution control and the research credit to drop then to the business energy credits at 7%, where that credit basically is for an investment by a business to use renewable energy or recycling projects, and the credit is equal to 35% of the cost of the certified project, and it's taken gradually over 5 years. And then the low-income housing is basically designed as a credit against corporate income taxes for lending institutions that make loans that are at below market rates. And so then the credit becomes the difference between the finance charges at the market versus the finance charges at the lower below market rate. And then the farm worker housing credit, this is allowed for owners of farm working housing that construct new housing. And this credit is equal to between 30 and 50% of the eligible construction costs. And the dependent care is basically for employees that are providing dependent care assistance to or information to their employees, and they're allowed a credit of 50% of the total cost of that employer's dependent care program.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
On farm worker housing.
Thank you.
It's you say it's 30 to 50% of the total cost of the housing?
Representative Farr, that's correct.
And what causes the variance there?
Representative Farr, I don't remember off the top of my head. I can't. Yeah. And just so everyone's clear, too, you know, I don't know if you've gotten them yet, but the tax expenditure report has all of that, and it has a good description of each one. So, you know, I'm happy to give you a copy of that, too, if you...
I don't want to seem nitpicky on a 2% slice of the pie, but it is becoming a much larger of an issue on and around farms. So, thank you.
Now, to go on and just kind of give you a few key points with our corporate excise tax. First of all, there's unitary reporting requirements here in Oregon, and this is basically going to require that businesses that are operating in Oregon and filing a federal consolidated tax return, they must then file a consolidated return here in Oregon. And so this was adopted in 1984. And basically, what another component of having this unitary reporting requirement is that the consolidated return that is combined at the federal level is combining the income of affiliated groups of corporations. It's excluding, though, the income of foreign affiliates. So we're at a water's edge requirement here. Now, and then once, as we were talking about, you have the federal income tax for the whole corporations and all the members of the corporation are filed the federal form, then it is apportioned, a portion of it is apportioned to Oregon if it's a multi-state corporation.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Can you correct me if I'm wrong? Was the unitary reporting method that was used on foreign corporations, the one that the legislature repealed, I think, early 80s, with Governor Attia in an effort to lure more Japanese corporations over here? Or am I thinking of a different unitary?
Representative Haas, I just know that we've had this unitary reporting requirement since 84, and
that's the change, the Water's Edge requirement. Yes.
Right, so just
change in the special session of 84?
Yes, it would have been 83, then maybe.
Yeah, but it was in a special session is when it was changed, yes. Right. Yeah, that would be the reference to the unitary reporting, so that you would limit your income reporting to basically what's in the country and not globally.
Yeah. That was a huge deal at the time, and it didn't involve just Oregon. It involved other states as well.
California in particular.
It was the big one, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So we'll go through some examples here with apportioning income to a state like Oregon and between the different states. And then, as we talked about before, S corporations' income then is passed through to the personal income tax system. So they pay the 5, 7, and 9 tax rate, but they have to file a corporate excise tax return because they are a corporation here in Oregon. Then they are going to pay the minimum excise tax of $10. Now, other C corporations may pay a minimum excise tax of $10 if they don't have any income or they don't have any tax liability. So then they would pay the minimum tax of $10. Now, this gives you a little bit of an understanding over the last 10 years and how basically the C corporations' returns have kind of changed, and the makeup of the net income for corporations has changed. Now, these yellow bars here are symbolizing the multi-state corporations versus Oregon-only corporations. So states that are operating in more than one state are considered multi-state corporations, and when you look at their percent of the total returns, that's what the yellow bars do. And as you can see, to begin with, in 1990, you saw only about 23% of all the tax returns were actually multi-state corporations. And then over 10 years, that has grown to over 33% of all tax returns. But the bigger change here really has been the multi-state corporation's income as a percent of the total net income. So as you can see here with the blue line, multi-state corporations started at roughly 70% of all of the net income in the state. And then they have grown over the last 10 years to probably 85% of all of the net income in the state are from multi-state corporations.
Net income from C corporations.
From C corporations, yes. These are just the C corporations' total net income.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, mm-hmm. I'm assuming that's the net income attributable to Oregon.
Representative Barnhart, that's correct.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm just looking at Oregon's data here. But it does give you a sense of how much that has changed. And you can see that even more as we kind of break down then the different income groups and whether that those tax returns that are experienced as losses. You can see with the yellow bars here, those are Oregon-only corporations versus the multi-state, which in the blue. And you can see in the loss category as far as the number of returns, 70% of all of the returns that experienced losses in 2000 were Oregon-only corporations. And even those that had income between 0 and 100,000, those were 70% Oregon-only corporations. So what you see is then this really big jump here when you go from 100,000 to 500,000, you're roughly about 45% for Oregon-only corporations, 55% for multi-state. But boy, once you get to 500,000 and above, then Oregon-only corporations only make up 20% or less of the total income in those groups. And so then you see the same when you split it out then by by income as far as the percent of total income. And in the loss categories, you do see some multi-state corporations experiencing losses, which make up a large portion of all of the losses there, which means that there are a few big multi-state corporations that experienced losses in 2000, so that they comprise nearly 70% of all of the losses. But then you can see it switches real quickly, where 0 to 100,000, that income group, that income was made up mainly by Oregon-only corporations, where they made up nearly 70% of all of that income in that group. And then it dropped significantly, started dropping most between 500,000 and above, where, again, Oregon-only corporations only make up about 20% of all of the income in that group. And this is just a quick overview of just the, if you combine now, again, not splitting them out between multi-state and Oregon-only corporations, just take the C corporations and their total returns versus net income in these different income groups, you can see that, you know, the large portion of the returns are in the loss category, are less than zero. As far as you've got over 22,000 returns there in that category. And then, so that's what the pink is, the number of returns, where the blue here is the net income. So it drops off significantly, so that you can see that the number of returns that are above 100,000, you know, are a very small portion of the total. But when you look at the net tax, on the other hand, obviously, at 0 to 100,000, you're not having much tax at all paid by those returns, and it hits 5 million at that at the 100,000 to 500,000. But it really takes off then after a million. So the majority of the tax, of the corporate tax, is paid by corporations with more than a million in income. Now, as we talked about before, this number of, like, in 2000 we had 375 million. You know, it's dropped significantly in 2001. We don't have the preliminary 2001 data like we had with the personal income tax, but we'll be getting that soon. But this, again, is kind of trying to give you the same graph that we saw last week when we examined the withholding payments by different sectors. And this is the same thing, only it is now the estimated payments, the estimated excise tax payments. And so everyone's clear, corporations make 4 estimated payments each year, and the first being in April and June and September and December. So
there's a metaphor in that graph. Yeah. I'm not sure what it is, but it says something to me.
Well, if you start to dissect this metaphor a bit, it begins at 1 here again in September of 1998, and that is the beginning point. And again, this is over a 12-month period, so the beginning point is September 1998, represents 12 months of estimated payments from September of 1997 till September of 1998. And so you can see there, like with the black line, is all the sectors together again. And you can see that that hit kind of a peak here, you know, right around February of 2001. Okay, and that is roughly showing that with an index of 1.5, that means that all sectors had grown in estimated payments annually 50% from September of 1998. And then we've seen it falling ever since.
I think maybe more than a metaphor, it's more like looking at an x-ray of a broken bone.
It's been shattered in various pieces, yeah.
So it's interesting that it's the only one that is still above 1 is the is it the retail trade? Yeah,
this one it's retail trade, yeah.
Which I think is consistent with what we're seeing nationally, retail trade holding up. But it's also interesting that even that has begun to tail off. How far out does that go to December?
That's November of 2002.
Interesting. Yeah. That's begun to tail off.
Yeah, and Representative Shetterly, you brought up a good point as far as helping people understand that when we're looking at the corporate income tax and excise tax payments, you're really looking at a lot more at the bigger, you know, again, the bigger corporations, so you're getting much more of a national look at the corporation as a whole because, again, we're portioning a portion of their income. So you do see a lot more trends that, you know, are not maybe as common as you would think, and it's not mirroring exactly everything we saw with the withholding payments, which are reflecting the employment here in Oregon. Now, I'll just, you know, the green obviously here is manufacturing, and so we saw, you know, the big drop here, you know, starting about March of 2001. And that, you know, it's just amazing how much manufacturing had grown from, you know, September of 1998, threefold. You know, until that period when it just finally started falling. And
I just want to reflect, I would come and fall that peak is just about the numbers we pegged the budget to.
Yeah, exactly.
Session, yeah.
Yes.
It's true.
No, it's true. And Representative Shetterly, we didn't at this time, you know, last year, sure. You know, 2 years, even have this data. So. Okay, so here's again a little bit more detail on the breakdown of the corporations and industries that actually had a decline between July of 2001 and November of 2002. And these are just the ones with a decline of more than a million. Now here again, manufacturing dropped the largest, 114.4 million. That's a 98% drop from July of 2001. And then the management of companies and enterprises, these are like holding companies, that dropped 22 million, 90%. Information, technology, media, that fell 16 million or 84% drop. Wholesale trade, you've seen that drop 15 million or 30%. Finance and insurance, that dropped 12 million or 28%. Transportation and warehousing, that dropped 5.6% or 70% on a percentage basis. Construction has been falling. That was 2 million. Mining fell 1.7 million or 81%. Real estate and rental and leasing, that dropped 1.4 million, 28%. And accommodations and food services, that dropped 1 million or 27%. So again, what the other trend that we saw, and clearly it'll be reflected when we start seeing some preliminary 2001 numbers, is, you know, again, estimated payments are just one side of it. Refunds are the other side, and refunds were definitely up for corporations, just like they were for withholding.
Do you want to marvel at that before we go on?
I'd just like to ask, the real estate figure surprises me, the 28%. Because during this time, you've had the low interest rates and a lot of activity. Explain to me why that figure would be at 28%.
Yeah, Representative Berger, I think one of the things, too, is the rental industry that is also incorporated in there. I mean, I think that can be also a pretty big, drag on that sector because you got like rental cars and things like that. Well, they're connected with the travel industry.
I'm going to guess too that commercial space is. I'm guessing there's a high vacancy rate, probably both in office and in early manufacturing. You've got a lot of empty buildings or unused space anyway that's out there.
I wasn't thinking broad enough. Okay.
Yeah.
There's a lot more in that figure. Okay.
Okay, now just to move with some examples and things of the corporate excise tax. And again, to just be clear with everyone, what we're talking about here, and when we talk about the multi-state apportionment, the apportionment formula is really attempted to measure a level of activity by a corporation within a state in order to determine whether or not there is an ability to tax them. And most corporate apportionment formulas are taking into consideration three different factors, or at least that becomes one component. It's considering whether to have three factors. And the first one being payroll, property, and sales. So those are the main components to that states will look at. And what we've been seeing and what needs to be clear is that you need to have this nexus, which is, again, is the ability of the connection in a state in order to actually tax that corporation. So the nexus occurs when a corporation has, like, it owns or leases property in a state. You could have, like, an office there. Maybe it leases office space or a warehouse. And also, the second way could be if it has capital or property employed in the state. And then third is if it employs any employees in the state, it has personnel there. And fourth, it also could, it has to derive income from the activities in the state. So as we'll, and Deborah will go into more detail too on this kind of sticky issue of nexus, but just make sure it's clear that you, in order to be able to tax in a state, you've got to have, you know, some physical presence beyond sales in order to justify taxing. So we will begin to look at some of the multi-state income apportionment formulas, and again, the three components being property, payroll, and sales. And what we've been seeing is that, you know, initially, way back in 1957 was when the Uniform Division of Income for Tax Purposes Act was enacted, and that really at that time was advocating or at least considering the traditional method being an equally weighted sales factor formula where every those three factors would be equally weighted 33%. But what we've seen is, and the majority of the states up until 1980 had this equally weighted sales factor apportionment formula. But beginning in the 1980s, then, that's when you started seeing some of the economic wars between states on their apportionment formulas. And then you're seeing now states gradually moving to more of a heavier weighted sales formula. So now we see that this is data from 2002 where we had basically had 47 states that have some kind of a corporate income tax, but 14 of them is all that's left that they actually use an equally weighted formula. And I've also incorporated in if there also are being some divisions in some states where they will let, you know, some sectors have an equally weighted formula and some have another, like, double-weighted sales. So there are some differences going on now between even different sectors. And you see that 26 states use a double-weighted sales, 5 use 100% sales, and 4 use a hybrid then between 50% and 90%. Now, Oregon has a double-weighted sales right now, but last session we changed the law to have to move into this hybrid system. So we've been moving, you know, from 25 of the double-weighted sales, and there'll be 5 then in this hybrid category after May of 2003. That's when that bill from last session legislation goes into effect. Now, this just gives you kind of an overview here of the different states and whether or not they have evenly weighted three-factor formulas, double-weighted formulas where sales is twice the weight of the payroll and the property, then the sales that are weighted 50% to 90% category, and the 100% weighted sales. And again, there are a few different, you know, caveats here with certain states where I have kind of like Oklahoma down here. I put them in here twice because there is an option here where if corporations are meeting an investment criteria, then they're allowed to double weight the sales factor. So there's a few things like that going on in different states. So it's not so clean cut that even they're fit into one of these, you know, categories. It can be different depending on the type of industry it is. Like in Maryland here, manufacturers can use one sales factor formula. Now,
manufacturer can use one, does that mean a
single sales factor, yeah. As you can see, and one of the reasons that surrounded Oregon moving to be in this hybrid now with a heavier weight than 50% on their sales factor is really to create incentives for corporations to invest in the state And the reason why is when you're lowering then your property factor and your payroll factor, then it's making it, you know, cheaper. There's less taxes than when you want to invest in a new plant in the state. Then that is what is creating then somewhat of an incentive by changing these apportionment formulas. Now, the real question becomes then is how much are these double-weighted, you know, states going to move then into, you know, this hybrid category like Oregon has just done? You know, it also depends on kind of the competitive advantage that you have with other states and what is the reaction of other states. Mm-hmm. So this is just, we're going to go through a couple examples here to just make sure everybody's clear on what is actually how you apportion business income, and then these differences then in these different apportionment formulas and how that affects taxes. Now, what we see is that in each state, like with this multi-state corporation A, they have both, they have all three, payroll, property, and sales in both Oregon and in California. And so they apportion their business income between Oregon and California only. And what you do then, in order to figure out how much is going to actually go to Oregon, Oregon is going to take their portion depending on what portion of the total then of each of these factors the whole entire corporation A has. So in this case, payroll, you can see that the employee compensation and things in Oregon is $12 million versus a total of $40 million. So when you, what you do is take $12 million and divide it by 40. That tells you then the portion of the payroll factor that is actually apportioned to Oregon. And in this case, it's 30%. And then in, and then 70% is apportioned to California. And then property, you can see property, again, you $20 million in value of all the different offices and things here in Oregon, and you would divide that by 50 to arrive at then 40% of the property factor is apportioned to Oregon versus 60% in California. And the sales, you can see that Oregon, being a smaller state than California, then the amount of sales that corporation had in Oregon was smaller, only 20% of the total. Then what you do is calculate the average, and in this particular case, we're assuming there's an equally weighted sales apportionment formula, okay? So we will begin to change these as we look at what effect that apportionment formula has. But if you just have them equally weighted, then you just come up with an average of 30% of all of the business income for Corporation A is allocated to Oregon versus 70% to California.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Thank you. And I trust that the sales factor in that is not just sales that occur to Oregon customers. It's total sales wherever the customer be located.
Representative Farr, it's a destination. So it's the sales that are coming to Oregonians.
Okay.
So they, and that's a good point to recognize that they may have been shipped from California, but the destination is where the sales get attributed to. So in this case, the corporation had $100 million in sales, but only 20 of that was destined to Oregonians. And that's why being obviously a smaller state like Oregon is compared to California, you're going to have a smaller amount of sales. Now, just to give you an example then, say this corporation had total net income of $5 million. Oregon then would get $5 million times 30% or $1.5 million. California would take that $5 million and times that by 70% to get $3.5 million. And then what you do for Oregon tax, you take the $1.5 million, and then you just times it by your 6.6% tax rate and to get your $99,000 in tax. Now we're going to think about a little bit more complicated situation, and one that is also kind of subject to a lot of discussion in states is a throwback rule. And basically here in Oregon we have a throwback rule where, like we were talking about, if the sales are going to a state that does not have a tax, then there is a potential for that sales to be thrown back to the original state that manufactured those sales. So we'll say in this particular example that Oregon is the manufacturer of the product that Corporation A is producing. And they sail to California and they sail to Washington. Well, as we know with Washington, there is not an income tax assessed on corporations there. So the question also is that not only does Oregon not tax there, and that could be a potential for a throwback then to the originating state that manufactured the product, but also that corporation A, in this example, has to have or show some presence there in Washington State. So in this case, in Washington, we can see that there's a payroll of $2 million. Okay, and that if that payroll of $2 million is not something that is in connection with soliciting other sales, which is one area of exclusion, if that is not the role of the payroll of $2 million, then that would establish a nexus then and a presence of that corporation in Washington State so that those sales could then be thrown back to Oregon. Now, like, say, the plumbing company or something in Portland, and they service the Vancouver residents. Well, that would be payroll, then, that they, you know, would have been establishing if they're in Washington State, and that's something that's way beyond just a sales type of soliciting. So if you have soliciting of sales, that is okay, and that will not establish nexus alone. So like if you just went to Washington State in order to try to promote your particular product at trade shows and things, then that's not such that it would establish an actual nexus and connection. But just recognize that if you don't have a state, like we're right next to Washington State without an income tax, the other way is like sales can get thrown back if you sell to any federal government, local government that will pay taxes on that. So that's another way you can have throwback. So basically this is the same example that we saw before, only we've just got, you know, one more state included here. To figure out the factors, then you just take, like for Oregon, 12 divided by 42, then that determines 28% of the payroll will be allocated to Oregon. And then again, the 20 divided by 50 gives you 40% of the property is actually allocated to Oregon. And with sales, you've got 20 million divided by 114 to give you 17% of the sales. Now that would give you an average, if there was no throwback, of 28% of all of Corporation A's business income would be attributable to Oregon. Now, if you have a throwback, like I was saying, because there is nexus in this payroll that is established in Washington State does constitute a physical presence, then what you see is that then those sales can get thrown back to Oregon. So you would not have these 15 sales here under Washington. Then you would increase the sales here in Oregon to 35. Then again, you would take the 35 divided by the 115, and that would then give you a new average with a throwback. So Oregon would be benefiting because we would now be going from 28% of the business income to 33% of the business income. And as you can see, these portions, you know, are not, if you have no throwback at all, there's 6% of the sales out there that are not attributable anywhere. They're not taxed in this example because Washington State doesn't have an income tax. So again, what you do is take the total net income, in this example, $7 million. You take the $7 million times 33% to give you $2.31 million. And then in California, you would take the $7 million times it by 66% to give you 4.62%. $4.62 million.
Representative Berger had a question.
And the reason, thank you, Mr. Chair. Elizabeth, the reason that Oregon gets it is because it was manufactured in Oregon.
Representative Berger, that's correct. Yes, it gets thrown back to the state of origin, wherever it was manufactured or came from.
Okay.
Could have been a warehouse in Oregon that, you know, was housing it, and then it shipped from, you know, Oregon. But it has to, the state that shipped it.
The state that shipped it.
Yeah.
Okay. This gets further
complicated. Yeah. I know, and this is the thing that Deborah will discuss in more detail, too.
Sure.
Yes,
Representative. Now, if I understand what you're saying correctly, the throwback requires a nexus in Washington in order to get the throwback. Now, is this based on some Supreme Court interpretations, United States Supreme Court, of or around tax law, or is it something that's purely part of Oregon law, or do you know?
No, Representative Barnhart, it's court cases.
Okay.
Yeah, and the Department of Revenue, I think, will go into more detail about those specific court cases that are really dictating, you know, these kind of standards.
Okay, so this rule actually does make sense to someone.
Yes.
All right.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
What if the manufacturing is done in different states? Is it where the headquarters is? And what happens if the manufacturing is done overseas?
Well, Representative Haas, I think Deborah will probably get into that kind of stuff. I mean, I think it's the final destination of where it's coming here in the States. I mean, if it's from overseas, you're not going to be able to throw it back to overseas.
But if it's like Nike, where the manufacturing is overseas...
Representative Haas, I think it comes to the particular state where, you know, I think they come to central locations and then they're shipped out, and it'd be that central location in the states that it ships them out. And it could be the headquarters. Okay, so in this particular example, you can see the Oregon tax is roughly 2.31 million times the 6.6% to give you a tax of $152,460. Now we're going to look at just two examples where we're changing then this apportionment formula to a double-weighted sales and then a super-weighted sales like we have now. And again, this is current law, this double-weighted sales here. And basically it's calculated the same way as far as you take this portion of the payroll, you know, the 12 million divided by 40 in order to get the 30% as we saw before, but then you just take a portion of that, in this case 25%, in order to get 7.5% of all of the payroll is attributable to Oregon. And then property, it's the same thing. You go 20 divided by 50, they give you, and then take that 25% of that, because that's all you're attributing it to property is 25%. So then that would be 10%. And then with sales, you can see that would be 20 divided by 120% times 50%, giving you the 10%. And then adding all those different factors together gives you 27.5% of all of the income for this corporation would then go to Oregon versus 72.5% that would go to California. And this, again, if you use the previous example where we had equally weighted sales, the 5 million, you can see that this 5 million, now we've got 27.5% of the total, well, where before we had 30% of the total. And then that created, now we've got 1.38 million versus 1.5 million, which is what we had before with equally weighted sales factor. So in California, you're seeing an increase in their amount that gets apportioned to them versus Oregon, which is having a reduction because it's putting more emphasis on sales. And as you can see, their portion of the total sales is not large. I mean, it's only 20% in this example.
Elizabeth, in the kind of the Reader's Digest version of this, I think what we're seeing here is the trade-offs involved in superweighting the sales factor because you're reducing the revenue to Oregon as a consequence of the application of doubling the sales factor, but the economic development argument of that is that because of that you are creating an incentive for this company to put more people to work and invest in more capital in Oregon because that's not increasing their proportionate share of tax liability to this within the state.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct, and you could maybe see these factors basically going up, the payroll and the property, and that would be the incentive component. And how much they go up by, you know, is really the question, and that really results from the changes in the tax policy and how much the corporations react.
Now, you're not going to make us look at this with the throwback thrown in.
No, I promise, no more throwback.
Thank you. I'm very pleased to hear about that. Fine. Now, it changed the focus for a second, if you would, on this slide. We don't actually control the way California does the apportioning. And just for the sake of argument, if they were using this... This equal apportionment system then some of the income of this corporation would escape taxation altogether, wouldn't it?
Representative Barnhart, I mean, yes, if this is not the same, I mean, we're just giving you a simple example, sure. But yes, yeah. You're correct. I mean, if these are 30%, 30%, 30%, you know, that's not the same, especially on something like sales in that case.
So for California, it would look like 70% on the as percentage of the total based on the first chart you put up, and 27.5% for Oregon. So you'd leave 2.5% sort of free gratis, as it were.
Yes.
Thank you.
That's the Democratic question. And that is one of the things you will begin to see more of, as we're seeing now a divergence, you know, in states where you've got a lot of different things going on. Now, the tax amount, again, is just taking $1.38 million times 6.6% to give you $90,750. Now, with the super-weighted sales, basically, and this is, again, what's going to happen after May of 2003 under our current law, we've got, again, the same procedure that is followed as far as the 12 million of payroll in Oregon is divided by the 40, and then you're timesing that by 10% instead of 25%. And that gives you 3%. Oregon will be getting a portion, 3% of the payroll, 4% of the property, and 16% of the sales, and to come up with a total of 23%, where California, if they adopted the same super-weighted sales, they would come up with 77% of the total. So these examples, I've used Oregon and California to be moving in the same direction with the same apportionment
form. I think based on the chart that you showed us earlier, California has double-weighted sales, isn't
that's
that right?
That's correct. Yeah.
So in real life, it wouldn't play out as neatly
correct.
As this.
Yeah. Correct. And as Representative Barnhart just pointed out, then these would be slightly bigger, the payroll and the property, but the sales would be lower for California. So then again, all you're doing is taking your net income, and then in this case, you're timesing 23% for Oregon at $1.15 million and versus California at 77%. So California's tax in this example goes up with super-weighted sales, and Oregon's goes down because the point being the difference between California's sales versus Oregon sales. You know, when the apportionment formula is just being moved in both these states uniformly, then the difference here clearly is illustrated from the difference in the sales. So then the tax goes down to $75,900. So I guess I would just say to summarize these examples, you know, as we've seen in the short run, you can be seeing some lowering of taxes in those states that have a small amount of sales in proportion to their property and payroll if they move to more of a heavier weighted sales component of their apportionment formula. But really, the long-term effects are much more difficult to predict, and that really does depend on the state's reaction and the corporations in the states, their own makeup, and then their reaction to these changes in the apportionment formula. And then also the other states, and what are they going to do? Are they going to begin to move to a more heavily weighted sales also? Then it takes away any kind of advantage that you as a state may be having in creating an incentive if all other states are in moving to a more of a heavier weighted sales apportionment formula also.
Okay.
Deborah's going to come up and go through some of her examples.
Deborah. Thank you, Elizabeth.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan, Department of Revenue. Thank you very much for having me here today. And I did just want to follow up and talk about some of the administrative issues, as Elizabeth mentioned, that we have at the Department of Revenue. And pretty much I want to focus on two areas, one nexus and then one the unitary requirements. So let me see if I can run this machine here. The first one, nexus, I think of that as simply a connection with a state. As Elizabeth mentioned, a state and a corporation need to have nexus in order for the state to impose a tax on the corporation. If a corporation is doing business in Oregon, then Oregon can tax some or all of the income of the corporation. and doing business means the corporation is engaging in a profit-seeking activity in Oregon. So, for example, here we have a corporation with headquarters in Seattle. The factory is in Washington. All of the sales are occurring in Washington. Logic tells you that Oregon would not be able to tax that corporation. And that's correct. Under the law, we would not be able to tax that corporation. It has no connection with Oregon. But what happens if this corporation starts engaging in activity outside Washington, and some of that activity is in Oregon? Then the question becomes, how much activity, what type of activity, how substantial is the activity? And those are the questions that we struggle with in trying to administer the corporate tax. Does this corporation have nexus with Oregon yet or not? So there are two clauses in the Constitution that we need to consider in determining nexus. One is the Commerce Clause, and the other is the Due Process Clause. And we'll talk about the Due Process Clause first, because that makes more sense, and it actually should have been that way in your handout. But let me just do this.
We'll call this kind of the throwback presentation.
This is the thank you, Mr. Chair. You're so much smarter than I, for the record.
I would. I'm not.
Yeah, that's not the case.
The Due Process Clause of the Constitution imposes two restrictions on the state's ability to tax. First of all, there has to be a minimum level of in-state activity before Oregon can tax the corporation. And then there must be some rational connection between the values that the benefits that the state provides that the corporation receives. So what has the state given to this corporation in order to ask for a tax in return? And if we back up to the Commerce Clause, even if you pass the Due Process Clause, you may be stopped by the Commerce Clause, which says that a state's tax cannot unduly burden interstate commerce. And through court cases, at least one court case, it's been established that if these four requirements are met, a state's tax will be upheld. One of those is the taxes applied to an activity with a substantial nexus with the taxing state. Now, one question has been whether substantial nexus actually means substantial physical presence. And that's a question that hasn't really been resolved, but the case said substantial nexus with the taxing state. The tax needs to be fairly apportioned. It can't discriminate against interstate commerce, and again, needs to be fairly related to the services provided by the state. So if the tax that's being imposed meets this requirement, it should be upheld in a court. So again, looking at this example of the Washington Corporation, it now has an office building in Oregon. It's making sales into Oregon. There are transactions going back and forth between the Washington entity and the Oregon entity. So clearly, in this case, Oregon would have the ability to tax the corporation on a part of its income, the income that would be apportioned to Oregon. There's a physical presence here, and nexus is established. What if it's less extensive than having a building in Oregon? What if you've backed up on that continuum? They don't have a building now. They're simply shipping product here, but they have people coming into the state. Ordinarily, having employees come into the state would constitute nexus because you have a physical presence, a person representing the corporation, and that would be enough to establish nexus and allow Oregon to tax that corporation. But there's another provision that comes in, and that is a federal law passed in 1959 called Public Law 86272. And for some reason, it's never actually had a name attached to it that I know, so it's simply referred to as Public Law 86272. What that law says is if the connection of the corporation with the state is merely the solicitation of sales of tangible personal property, that does not establish taxable nexus with the state. In this example, that Washington corporation is shipping product into the state, but its only connection with the state is to send in salespeople to solicit sales on behalf of the corporation. They don't have any other personnel here. They don't have any other activities here. And there are other requirements. The orders have to be processed out of state. the product has to be shipped from out of state, and so on. So for us, determining the level of activity of that corporation and whether or not they meet this protection of federal law is a challenge. And there have been a number of court cases dealing with this public law because it is a national law. The Wrigley case, for example, dealt with the Wrigley Chewing Gum Corporation. And in that particular case, the court found that where the salespeople were coming into the state and soliciting orders, but they were also pulling out the stale gum and replacing it with fresh gum, created taxable nexus for the corporation. So they then had nexus in that state, and that state was entitled to tax a part of their earnings. So these are the things that we look at, the things that we struggle with in trying to determine whether or not a corporation has nexus with Oregon. So what types of activity are protected, excuse me, under Public Law 86-272? Well, again, simply soliciting the sale of tangible personal products. What things are not protected activity, if a corporation engages in this activity in Oregon, if they're approving or accepting orders in the state, that's not protected. Those have to be done out of state. If they install the product here, it is not protected. If they send staff in to make repairs or provide technical assistance, if they pick up or replace property, if they maintain a sample or display room, if they own, lease, use, or maintain facilities or property in this state, that takes them out of the protection of 86-272, collecting delinquent accounts, and so on. Now,
Mr. Chair, point of clarification, please. So if the salesperson is simply soliciting but not taking the orders, they are protected?
Mr. Chair, Representative Farr, the salesperson can only solicit, and the orders need to be transmitted back to the out-of-state property and filled, approved and filled from out-of-state.
Okay.
So it's simply soliciting the order.
It seems that probably wouldn't happen very often, right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Farr, that's one of the things that we struggle with, because a corporation that wishes not to have nexus with Oregon will try to structure the activity so that is all they are doing.
And it's a fine line in practical terms, you know, sometimes. Let's see, Representative Barner had a question.
What does using mean in this in the sixth bullet down, third up from the bottom? That's another one, isn't it, that could be a problem?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, yes, using could be the salesperson comes in and brings with them some type of company property that's not necessarily used to solicit sales. An example is not coming readily to mind.
Well, if I may, an example that occurred to me would be using a room in a conference center to make a presentation about the product.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, that could be simply soliciting sales, but if it is a presentation on how to use the property, use the equipment that you just purchased, that probably would not be simply soliciting sales. So as the chair pointed out, it is a very challenging area. There is no bright line standard as to what determines nexus.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I realize that there have been weekend seminars on this question,
yeah.
But I'm just wondering, where are we now on protected activity within this application on Internet sales and catalog sales?
Mr. Chair, Representative Haas, the Internet sale and catalog sale question generally comes up in the context of sales and use tax. And that's where a lot of the court cases have been. And what is protected activity in terms of I'm going far afield here, because it's coming back to me that perhaps this doesn't apply to the sales and use tax. So let's see. Protected activity in the area of income tax and Internet.
If you want to just send him a brochure to a weekend seminar.
Perhaps I need to present a weekend seminar. Can I get back to you on that, Representative Hass?
Really getting into complicated stuff. Representative Scott.
Thank you. Mine will probably be about the same. I was curious if the Internet sales, if it's simply rented space in a warehouse in Oregon, if it not leased but simply rented from a public facility.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, that would constitute nexus because the company actually has a physical presence here that goes beyond solicitation of sales of tangible
property. Anything like Amazon.com that has a warehouse in the state from which orders are filled?
Yeah. Right.
That would be nexus?
That would constitute nexus, yes. Mm-hmm. All right. The other point I wanted to make here is that it's not necessary that there be consistent reporting for corporations between states. That is, because it is a gray area, there's room for interpretation. So a corporation could, for example, argue that it has nexus with Idaho for purposes of determining Oregon's corporate tax, yet when it comes to Idaho, because it is such a gray area, there's an argument to be made that they don't have nexus with Idaho. So in that case, they would not be filing with Idaho, or perhaps they would file with Idaho but report that they have no nexus. And yet on the Oregon return, they would be throwing those sales to Idaho, making the opposite argument. That, I think, is called good tax planning on the part of accountants and attorneys.
Representative Berger has a question.
Yes. My question is, how big a problem is it? In other words, is this a real big problem? Is it a growing problem for Oregon?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, I'm not sure I would categorize it as a problem. It's simply one of the challenges in tax law. Unless there's going to be a bright-line standard that defines nexus for the states, you will always have this gray area where there's disagreement and debate about the level of activity, the extent of activity, and what that activity means. There are discussions now at the national level about establishing a bright line nexus test. So you would simply look at the dollar amount of sales in a state, or the dollar amount of property, or the dollar amount of payroll in a state to establish whether or not you have nexus with that state and have a filing and reporting requirement. But until that happens, I think this is always going to be something that reasonable minds can disagree on.
Mm-hmm. And we have had some discussions about this. There may be federal legislation within the next year dealing with this, primarily driven by the sales tax states, but it would have an impact on us as well.
Of course, it may be a sales tax state by
Okay. So we talked about the out-of-state corporation, but the same sort of rules apply to the homegrown Oregon corporation that starts doing business outside the state. In this case, we do have an Oregon corporation that starts to ship a product into Washington, and I actually should have made this Idaho to make things simpler because Idaho does have the corporate tax. So just imagine that this is Idaho rather than Washington. Those of us that are geographically challenged, that's not hard. So in this case, again, they're shipping a product into Idaho, but they don't have any other type of connection with Idaho except for that salesperson that's going there to solicit sales of tangible personal property.
Solicit sales and fill orders?
No, sir.
Just solicit?
Simply solicit sales.
Okay.
The orders need to be filled from Oregon. So in that case, if that's all that's happening in Idaho, that corporation does not have nexus with Idaho, and the throwback rule would apply, and this is what Lizbeth was talking about. You might want to keep this in mind, although keep it as Idaho. The sales to Idaho would be thrown back to Oregon. And the theory behind that and the simple policy decision for you when that comes up in this committee regarding the throwback rule is, should 100% of the corporation's income be taxed in some state? Because it doesn't have nexus with Idaho, Idaho is not going to impose an income tax. It's thrown back to Oregon so that 100% of the tax is imposed by Oregon. If you took away the throwback rule and said that that's going to be apportioned or thrown to Idaho, even though it's not taxable there, then 70, 60, 50% of the income is what's being taxed by the states. So that's really the simple policy question that would be before you.
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Barnard.
What confused me about that issue when it came up before was that I thought I heard it being stated the other way, that establishing nexus in Idaho is what caused the throwback. And in fact, what I understand you to say is that not having nexus in Idaho causes the throwback.
That's right.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, that's okay. Correct.
And I'm sure she said it correctly. I just misheard it.
So that's pretty much it for nexus. Lizbeth talked a little bit about the unitary concept, and most states use either combined unitary reporting or separate accounting to define the taxable base for a corporation. And what you're doing here is simply saying what is going to be taxable. If they're taxable by Oregon, what's going to be taxable? In Oregon, we use unitary reporting, and that ignores the separate legal existence of the entities. The focus instead is on the practical business reality. What is really happening with this group of corporations? How are they earning the income? So if you have an exchange of value between the corporations, then you combine them and you look at the total income of the group to figure out what needs to be apportioned. In this example, if we did not have unitary reporting, you could have a Washington corporation and an Oregon corporation acting as separate legal entities, even though they're exchanging value between the two corporations. With separate reporting, that Washington corporation would not be included in the total income that's to be apportioned. And this is the type of situation that came up in a court case a few years ago in the East. It was the Jeffrey case, where a corporation was set up and intangible assets were put into that, and then there were royalty payments going back and forth. And the state in that case had separate accounting, and the intent of the corporation was to minimize their tax, obviously. So what they could do is move income to a low-tax or no-tax state, keep losses in a higher-tax state, and use that to their best advantage. For Oregon, what you do is you look at the total group of affiliated corporations, you say what's the income that this group is getting, and then that's the base to use in apportionment. So that helps to simplify those problems. The advantage of unitary reporting, again, you can minimize the shifting of income or expenses, but it is more complicated from an administrative standpoint. If you think about what needs to be done from an auditing standpoint to determine who's going to go into this affiliated group, what are the activities between the corporations? Are they exchanging values? Do they get something from each other? What is that contribution? That is more complicated than simply looking at the set of books that a corporation prepares in order to calculate the tax based on that. And there's no bright line test here either, which means it can be subjective as to what goes into that group. And that's the South Carolina and Jeffrey case that I mentioned there at the end, where the taxpayers attempted to shift. The South Carolina Supreme Court ruled against the taxpayer in that case. They found that there was nexus in South Carolina, even though the company had no physical presence at all. The U.S. Supreme Court declined to hear the appeal of that case. So those are just probably some of the main issues that we look at in trying to administer the corporate tax. And then finally, if you look at this little picture that we have seen and consider that these companies are doing business globally, not just in Washington and Oregon and Idaho and California, but across the United States and globally, it does become more of a challenge for us to attempt to collect the right amount of tax from the corporations that are doing business in Oregon and across the United States. I'd be happy to try to answer any questions that you might have or send you a brochure.
Yeah, to a weekend seminar.
Yeah.
Representative Farr.
Thank you. Oregon calculates on a unitary basis. What if they're working with a state that doesn't, if they disagree on the apportionment?
Mr. Chair, Representative Farr, there is a statewide national organization, the Multi-State Tax Commission. Mm-hmm. Oregon is a member of that. And that organization acts somewhat as a sounding board or a mediator. A corporation that believes it's being double taxed, for example, in two states, or they're taking the same position on an issue and they're being treated unfairly, they can go to the commission and ask for a review of that, kind of a second opinion.
Are all states members of the commission?
Mr. Chair, Representative Farr, I don't believe all of them are, but a great number of them are, and I can get you some information on that if you'd like.
And is that actually an interstate compact, then? Is that what the multi-state commission
is? Multi-state tax compact,
yeah.
I guess my question then becomes, what if a state, a company operating in a state that's not a member of the commission, disagrees with Oregon.
Is that why we go to court sometimes?
That's when we go to court.
That probably would be the answer. Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Clark.
Thank you.
Other questions?
In that you don't know the answer, I probably wouldn't understand the answer.
Yeah, that's right. Great clip art, Member. Thank you for that. And for your information, too. Good report.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yep, excellent.
Yep. Appreciate you taking the time to put that together and helping light. We will see some bills on some of this session, so I promise you, though, when we do, we will spend a little bit of the time kind of briefing, rebriefing again on some of the bigger issues. But like a lot of these things, they bear repetition just because they're so unfamiliar to those of us who don't deal with this on a daily basis. That concludes our overview on corporate tax. We have before us today three bills for committee introduction. LC 1033 relates to reduction in the capital gains tax. LC 1034 is an expansion of the research and development tax credit. And LC 1777 establishes the Municipal Street Tree Restoration Program in the State Forestry Department. Okay. LC 1033 comes at the request of the Associated Ag Industries, as does 1034. LC 1777 comes to us at the request of Oregon Community Trees. Well, I guess everybody has a lobbyist.
Probably from Eugene.
Well,
so
this one wouldn't be from Eugene because there's nothing in it that requires native trees to be here.
I see. Chair would move introduction of LC 1033, 1034, and 1777 as committee bills, again on the understanding that nothing in this commits anybody to support any of these and is not an expression of support by the committee, but rather just
should be at the request.
I'm sorry, yeah, I meant I read that. We'll make that part of the motion so that 1033 at the request of Associated Oregon Industries, 1034 at the request of Associated Oregon Industries, and 1777 at the request of Oregon Community Trees. That will be part of the motion. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, those bills are introduced at the request of those respective organizations. And with that, we are adjourned for today, Paul. Tomorrow we will be looking at the tonight's news, the outcome of ballot measure 28 and its implications, revenue implications for the remainder of this biennium and next, and what else?
Well, and Mr. Chair, if measure 28 does pass, then we've asked the Department of Revenue to talk about implementation.
Okay.
They'll have to, of course, to move right away to change the withholding tables, and Deborah will talk with us about that a bit. We also have, for public hearing, possible work session, House Bill 2023, and House Bill 2185 on the agenda.
All right. Got some bills to get working on tomorrow. So, see you all 8:30 tomorrow morning here. And with that, Kim?
2285.
2025. Yes, I did. Yeah, I did it this time. Yeah. All right.
She's trained us.
With that, then, we are adjourned. Thank you.